This is an ABC podcast.
Not so long ago, Bernadette Agius had a meeting in town. So she slept the night at her son Richard's house. He cooked her dinner, made up the bed, took good care of his mum as a guest at his place. It wasn't something Bernadette thought she'd ever experience. Richard was born with Down syndrome, and doctors told Bernadette not to expect too much of her son. Richard has been proving them wrong ever since. Hi, Bernadette.
Hi, Sarah.
Now, I called you Bernadette, but what do your family call you?
Everyone calls me Benny. I went to one of those Catholic schools where there were a lot of Bernadettes. And so to make life a lot easier, we all got shortened. And my dad always called me Ben.
You'll be Benny to me.
If Benny
today.
Is good.
So tell me about your family. You come from a big family.
I come from a very big Maltese family. My grandmother had 18 children. I know people fall off their chair, as you just did when I say that. And I have 64 cousins. And it's the most loving, generous, kind, funny, very loud family. We were four when I came to Australia because Malta was very poor then. And my dad, who was the motor mechanic, really wanted a better life for his wife and then three daughters. We're now four. And they came to Australia not knowing very much. My mum had some of her siblings here already. Some went to Mackay, some were in Sydney. And so they established a life here.
And whereabouts in Australia did your family end up?
Well, we ended up in Sydney and initially inner city Sydney. But then, of course, they did what a lot of migrants do and went out west where the Catholic priest was Maltese and the community was Maltese. So it was a safe place for them where they knew people and their girls could grow up in a safe environment, I guess.
How much of life revolved around the Catholic Church? How big a part of your childhood was that?
Oh, it was pretty big. It was the school. It was every Sunday. It was baptisms, confirmations, communions, Christmas, Easter, and the parish priest would come to our house and drink whiskey with my dad. And, you know, it was a pretty intense Catholic high school. The head nun at Catholic high school had the same birthday as me, so my mum would invite her to share our birthday.
Thanks, Mum.
Yeah, great. So it was just, you know, a very loving family, warm. I had three great sisters and, of course, we fought and bickered
And as well as looking after her four daughters, did your mum do paid work?
She did indeed. She worked at a factory and that's where she learned a lot of her very bad English because she started picking up a lot of swear words. But she, you know, came to Australia without much English. Dad had quite a bit. But then she learned and, you know, she'd say things that would make us all laugh. Like she'd say, oh, that has a northerly aspect. And we'd all fall on the floor laughing, going, oh, my God. And she'd go, what? Is that right? Wrong?
And so what was expected of you four daughters when you were growing up? What did your mum and dad want for you?
Oh, look, they wanted us to be educated. That was first and foremost for them. They weren't really that fussed about getting married. For my mum and dad, it was education, travel, be good people. That was really important to them. Be kind to others. We're very lucky. We've got this great new life. And then, you know, get married if you want to. But mum always wanted us to get married. But dad was very much, you know, see the world, travel, explore, you know, enjoy, which was very unusual for a Mediterranean man of that vintage. But certainly education and work. You had to get a job. You couldn't just, you know, from the moment you were 14 and 9 months, you got your part-time job.
What was your first part-time job?
I worked in a newsagent close to where we lived out at Greystanes. And it was so fun. It was just great. Actually, no, I had a job at Australia Square working in the car park downstairs. So, and that was on weekends. So we had, you know, we were taught very early on that we needed to work. It was a big part of our lives.
What did your mum and dad think, Benny, about you moving in with your boyfriend after you'd left high school? How did that go down?
So not well. I was a little lucky in that I thought I'd make a really good nurse. And in those days, you actually lived in the nurse's quarters. So I had that kind of transition where I could jump from that. And actually, I made a really bad nurse because I couldn't stand the sight of blood and fainted often. So I gave that up as a career. And then I actually moved into an apartment with some girlfriends, but then moved in with the boyfriend. And, oh, Mum, gosh, she was just livid. She actually laid in bed with the screaming almost going, I can't believe you're doing this to me. I think I might have been, I don't know, 21 or something. But for her, it was a sign that she wasn't providing enough or that, you know, I was a wayward person. I just wanted to live close to the city. And I shouldn't even come visit the apartment, but eventually she forgave me and we moved on.
Did she want you to have a life more like hers, to have kids, to have the husband, the whole setup?
Yeah, that's exactly what she wanted. She thought that was the perfect life, having a husband and children. I thought that was so not the perfect life. I wanted to travel and see the world and do whatever I wanted to do before I settled down.
Did you think about being a mum at some point? Was that part of what you wanted?
Oh, look, occasionally, the tiny, tiny, tiny bit, I'd go, oh, it'd be nice to have a family. And then I thought, oh, no, I've got to go and see a band and I've got to, you know, drink and party and travel. That just sounds so boring, having a family. And I was lucky that my sister had her beautiful little girls very early on, so I could be their auntie and spoil them. And I enjoyed them, but I could always give them back.
Well, how did you feel then, Benny, when you discovered that you were pregnant, you were going to have a baby?
Oh, I was elated and scared at the same time and thought, oh my God, am I going to be a mother? Is this my next thing in life? And I kind of had thought that it would happen at some stage because my husband and I at the time had bought a 4-bedroom house in suburban Sydney.
Someone's got to live in all those rooms.
I thought a couple of dogs would be nice. But it was great. And I kind of went, okay, I can do this. This is probably where I'm meant to be. And certainly my family were ecstatic that I was going down that path. Happily married, children, and I was going, yeah, okay.
And were you calling your baby by a name back then? Were you one of those mums who had a name picked out before you'd given birth?
Absolutely. And I couldn't, I couldn't even wait to find out the sex. So as soon as I could find out the sex, we did. And I initially wanted to call Richard Sam, but Richard's dad wanted to call him Richard. So that was good. I was just really worried people would call him Dick. You know, I just thought, oh my God, I don't want a Dick in the family. Like, you know, everyone was called, I think, how did you become a Richard to become a Dick? Anyway, so we made it very, very clear to people he was Richard. So, yes, I found out the sex and I always spoke to him as Richard.
And was there anything unusual picked up in any of the ultrasounds that you had while Richard was in utero?
Well, it wasn't unusual in that the doctor didn't think it was unusual, but we had the test, the blood test that just said, yeah, everything looks okay, you don't have to do anything. And I was 30 at the time and there was an ultrasound where the limbs were showing 16 weeks, but he was actually 18 weeks. And the obstetrician kind of went, oh, look, that's, you know, that's okay. That sometimes happened. But I was quite niggled by that. I just didn't feel that was quite right. And then this whole thing about, you know, people going, oh, my God, he kicks all night long. Or I wasn't getting that. I wasn't getting that real, you know, kick. It was more like a little punch rather than a big kick. So I kind of always felt there was a little something quite not happening that should be happening.
And when you and Richard's dad were imagining your son's future, what sort of future did you have in mind? How did you envisage the life of this little boy you were going to bring forth?
Oh, this little boy, Sarah, was going to rule the world. He was going to become either a famous film star or president of America or, you know, go to Oxford and, you know, discover the cure for cancer. You know, he was not going to be boring. He was going to, you know, the bar was high. He was going to be the school captain. He was going to be devilishly handsome. I had it all. You know, I would literally be on the train just looking out the window daydreaming about what this kid was going to be like. Crazy, like that was really crazy stuff. And I kind of never in a million years thought that wouldn't happen. Like I really didn't think that would not happen.
Where were you when you went into labour, Benny?
I was at home and I was in the bedroom reading and we were renovating. So Richard wasn't due till the first week in April. And so my husband was putting the first coat of varnish on our newly renovated wooden floorboards when my waters broke. And a tree had come down outside the back. So there was no actual exit of the house. So there I was screaming out going, my waters have broken. And he's in there going, what now? I've just put the first coat of varnish on. So then I had to climb over this tree.
While you were in labour.
Oh, yeah, and all this stuff, gunk everywhere, it was awful. So we got in the car and drove down to the hospital and Born Free came on, which was so funny. I was thinking, oh my God, this is so wonderful. You know, this is, you know, the whole golden mane thing. Both Richard Dan and I had dark hair. So we're both thinking, I'm thinking, where's this golden haired kid coming from? But it was that kind of, you know how things go into slow motion when you're in that place where you think, oh my God, my life is about to change right now. This is it.
And that moment when you were handed your little baby boy, what do you remember about that first moment together?
Oh, it was so beautiful. I looked at this little creature and you know, you hear all those stories there and I just fell in love. I just thought, oh my God, he is so precious and so beautiful. But what had happened was when he flew out, they kept looking at him and the midwives kept looking and looking. And I kept saying, what is it? Is it a boy? Is it a boy? And it took them a long time to tell me what he was. And then they sort of handed me to him. And that sort of, that moment of, oh, wow, he's here. And then they said, oh, we need to take him away now because he's really jaundiced. And I must admit I was a bit tired because I'd been all night long without sleep. So I was kind of, oh, yeah, great, you know,
and
make him clean.
Were you calling your family, your mum and dad, to let them know?
Everyone. It was like, hi, we've got this beautiful boy. He's so precious. He's so gorgeous. He looked a little bit like my Auntie Doris. So I kind of went, oh, okay. but he was beautiful, like really beautiful. And, you know, ringing, celebrating. I rang my friends. I rang family. I was on the phone. Yay. And then kept taking a little bit longer and a little bit longer and a little bit longer, and suddenly the room was filled with doctors, nurses, interns, and they walked in and I thought, oh my God, he's died. Something awful has happened to this child. And I was, oh, and I just remember them just all staring at me, and the head pediatrician, a beautiful woman who became very much part of our family, Dr. Grass, said, look, we believe your son has Down syndrome. And I went, oh, God, is that all? Which was like, everyone kind of looked at me like, she's really strange. And I looked at Richard's dad, who clearly didn't have any idea. He was white. And so I think then I kind of realised that this was pretty big. And then Dr. Grass was telling me things which I was kind of taking in and out. And all the time I was flashing back to a family friend who we used to get our beautiful dresses made. Mum had our dresses made from the local dressmaker, and she had a daughter who had Down syndrome. And we were kids, little, you know, 8, 10-year-olds. And this little girl was nonverbal. She was quite violent, I guess, and scary. But we used to have a lot of fun with her and laughed a lot. But that was all I thought, oh my God, he's going to be just like her.
What causes Down syndrome, Benny?
Look, I think the jury's out on that. It's a chromosomal disorder. It can happen to anyone, any age. You know, I've known people as young as 18 and as old as 47. Look, and my science is really bad and I don't want to confuse people, but it is just that the one chromosome has literally a little leg that's different, and it causes this extraordinary change in people.
And could the doctors back then give you much detail about what was to be expected?
It was all pretty doom and gloom, except actually that obstetrician was fantastic. He came in to see me and he said, look, you've been given a blessing. You will love your son. I know that you're a strong person. Go home and love him and everything will be okay. But then the reality of that kind of next step of what does this mean? What does it mean for his future? And so basically there are levels of Down syndrome. So it's like the rest of, you know, society. We have very smart people with Down syndrome and not so smart people with Down syndrome. And the intellect can, you know, is based on the IQ, but we had a test at some stage when Richard was quite young, and the testing in those days basically had the standards were he's either going to be an idiot, an imbecile, retarded, or it was just
they were the actual terms.
They were the actual terms that they used then. Now we use mild, moderate, severe disability, but in those days he could either be an idiot or an imbecile, which I laugh about it now, but it was pretty confronting at the time.
So after you'd received this knowledge, it was totally unexpected that your new little baby was born with Down syndrome. Did you make phone calls again? I mean, did you have to tell people, okay, this, wait a minute, update. How did that get handled?
That was so hard. That was actually, even now when I think about it, because I just, it was from going from the happiest, most beautiful time in your life to, I don't know, just disappointment and fear. I was really fearful. I thought, oh, what's his life going to be like? And of course, what's my life going to be like? Because it's always about me. But I really feared for him, his health, his well-being, his capacity to live a good life, his capacity not to be shunned by people or hurt by people. So all these emotions happened really quickly.
How did people react, your family react, when you told them?
Oh, look, it was really good. My family are just so extraordinary. So my sister waltzes in with champagne, balloons, joyful expression. We're so happy. Welcome, Richard. My mother says, oh, my God, he's a blessing. You look terrible. Put some lipstick on.
You're kidding.
Oh, yeah, she's hilarious. So she goes rummaging through her bag and pulls out lipstick.
As you're in the labour ward having just
wanting to kill myself. And she's going, you look really terrible. Put some lipstick on. And she said, oh, I've got some blusher as well, if that helps.
Was it a knock for them, though? Because, I mean, were they afraid of what was going to be ahead for their little grandson?
They were afraid for me, actually. My dad was really afraid for me because he kind of went, you know, Richard will be fine because we'll love him. But, you know, this is a lot of difference for you. You know, you've got a career, you are a vibrant, interesting woman who's now having to change how her outlook is. And I found him one day in his bedroom crying. He was just looking at Richard in the cot, and it was heartbreaking to see that. But then, you know, family is so important, so crucial, and they kind of had the attitude that it's not going to make a difference, that we're not going to treat him. And actually, Richard's dad and I made this pact very early on. Richard first, disability second. So when those phone calls, those important phone calls of, you know, medical, early intervention, all those things, we always made sure that we put him first. Is this too much? Is this going to destroy him? But then I kind of went into that really batshit crazy place where, he's going to still achieve these important milestones.
Well, you'd been raised in such a religious family. Did you find yourself turning to God in the aftermath of this?
Oh, poor God. I made so many important kind of phone calls to God going, so, but the big thing I did say to God, because I sort of would sometimes go to church and sometimes not, although I used to lie to my mother and tell her I'd go every Sunday. But I said to God, look, I really want you to do three things. And the three things went like this, Sarah. I said to him, I want Richard to be able to read and write. That was so important to me because if you can read a railway timetable or a bus stop or any of those things or even a newspaper, that was important. And to write, to be able to communicate, that was huge. And actually probably even more important than that, I said, God, he needs to speak to me. One of the real problems with people with Down syndrome is that their speech is often difficult to understand and sometimes not at all, so they're nonverbal. And I'm so lazy. The thought of learning Auslan and doing sign language and, you know, me talking 10 to the dozen and trying to sign at the same time was not something I was comfortable with. So I said, God, he has to speak to me. I want him to tell me he loves me. I want him to tell me when he's cranky. I want him to be able to say joyful things and sing Christmas carols. And that was important. And then the third thing, which is really, probably Richard will kill me for saying this, but I really wanted to be able to wipe his own bottom because I didn't want to do that either. I thought, nah, that's something I'm not going to do.
So this is what you asked of God. Did you have any, you know, were you offering anything in return or was it a one-way deal?
I'd go back to church. No, I'd go back to church and I'd be a better person and not so arrogant and vain.
So one way of working with Richard those early days was praying. What else? Like, when did you start thinking we need other help and what was available back then? We're talking 30 years or so
ago. It was.
What kind of programs were there for little kids?
Very little, very, very little. And first of all, I had two beautiful women come and see me from the Down Syndrome Association from New South Wales. And thank God for those people because Suzanne and Carla both had little boys and their boys were doing quite nicely. They told me about a program that Macquarie University had in those days, and it was an early intervention program specifically designed for little kids with Down syndrome. And you basically started at 6 weeks.
At 6 weeks?
At 6 weeks, and they only took like two kids a year. I drove them insane I called them every morning, every afternoon, trying to get Richard in. And eventually they rang back and said, he's in. And I felt like I'd won the lottery.
And so what were they doing with babies at such a young age?
Look, it was about to start with the muscle tone. So people with little babies with Down syndrome have really low muscle tone. So that makes walking harder. It means getting those early stage developmental things takes longer. So it was just teaching us how to, in play, when you're playing with our babies, to, you know, do things that would eventually get to those milestones. So, you know, even things like rolling, you know, for babies with Down syndrome to roll sometimes is hard. And it also was things like muscle tone of the mouth so that speech would be better. So it was a whole kind of suite of activity that you could do. And this was from 6 weeks old. And then you moved into, you know, 1-year-old. So then it became things like little pincer grips of sultanas and pegs. And so each one of those things, so that little grip would be good to do up your buttons, for instance. So what you did then would have a consequence for what you did later on. And so they were, it was just a whole lot. So there was that. Then there was the physical stuff that you could do as well. Speech pathology. There was a whole lot of things that went into that program.
Sam, what was going on for you? I mean, it's a crash course for anyone learning to be a mother with a baby, but you were suddenly the mother of a child with a disability. Were you on some crash course of learning all of these skills and I guess a whole other world that you hadn't had exposure to before?
And other language. Like, you know, I knew books. That was my life. And I had no, like I, you know, lucky I knew what a nappy was and had seen one. So, you know, it was a really big, steep learning curve for me, just motherhood, let alone this other world. And I, of course, took it on with enormous amount of vigour and thought, right, we're going to do this and we're going to do this so well. I drove that poor kid crazy. Like there was, you know, not a waking moment.
What did you do?
Oh, I was always singing to him, talking to him. I was moving his legs whenever we could. I was sort of rolling him over. And look, any opportunity I had to kind of engage. So of course he never slept because he was so hyped up.
Was he exhausted though? I mean, was it stressful turning your home into a kind of a therapy session? Was that difficult sometimes?
Yeah, it was. And then you felt guilty because I sort of went to this place, if I don't do this and he fails, then it's on me. And I didn't want to be judged that I was a mother that failed, basically. Richard's dad, bless his heart, was so much more relaxed that he would just be enjoy being Richard's dad, whereas I was always setting that bar really high. And then eventually what happened, of course, was it became so stressful I ended up having terrible panic attacks and having some mental health issues because I didn't want to fail.
What sort of therapies were you doing at home? One is you're speaking around the clock. What else? What other physical things were you doing with his legs, for instance?
So they, you know, there's little sweatbands that tennis players, so you'd connect two of those together and you'd have them wrapped around Richard's knees so that when he crawled with those together.
Why?
Just so that it would create strength and that the legs wouldn't bow, so that that was... And tell you the truth, I really can't remember now. It was so long ago and I wasn't very good at it. and there were things like, you know, just getting him to crawl over boxes and play, just general things. And I heard of a mother once that put the milk bottle down at the end of the room and had the baby at the other end so that it would move. It would just go down there to get to be fed.
To be fed, that's a motivation.
It wasn't, you know, we were doing all these crazy things. Whereas if you just had a, you know, normal kid, you would just go through those things would happen naturally.
What about sultanas? How did they come to play an important part in your family home?
Oh, look, we had so many sultanas. The dogs loved them. The dog would just wait underneath Richard's high chair and wait for the little morsel, which was often. So it was just so he would learn how to pick them up with two little fingers. So he'd put strength in his fingers so he could hold a pen. So he could write.
And so did all of this start to come together? Were you starting to see results for Richard by the time he was a toddler? What was he like as a toddler?
Oh, my God, he was so cute. He was so cute and adorable and got his own way with everyone. He was the grandson of one family, only grandchild, the other family, only grandson. The three nieces just went, a boy. I was one of four girls. It was a boy. The women at the Macquarie Centre just loved him. It was like, and so he was just gorgeous but sweet, had just such a sweet nature. He was beautiful.
Tell me about the time you caught him out at Christmas.
Oh, my God.
And why that was meaningful.
It was so funny. So it was Christmas Eve. I had the big family coming. We were hosting Christmas that year. And I had the tree stacked with presents with the little nieces and sisters. And I wanted to clean outside. So I put Richard in front of the telly with the remote control and the dog. And I left them there in front of, I think, Barney the purple dinosaur, and went outside to clean the back. And suddenly I just got this feeling that something wasn't quite right. And I went inside and it looked like Armageddon. There was wrapping and gifts and mayhem.
He'd unwrapped everything.
He had unwrapped every single. It was like it was a frenzy. And he was sitting there, the dog had paper covered all over him, the television, the tree was lopsided. And he looked at me and I was about ready to scream. And he went and pointed to the dog and said, "He did it." And I was so proud of him for telling a lie.
What do you mean you were proud of him telling a lie? Why?
Why? Because he had the cognition to know he'd done something wrong. It was like, oh, that's really good. You know what lying is about.
You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Benny, you've been describing how you were so focused on developing Richard's speech and physical abilities with intervention programs and with home, and that's all the stuff that you kind of had agency and control over. What was it like when you took Richard out into the world? What kind of reactions did you get from strangers?
Oh, that was when I really found it very difficult. People would stare, and some stare in that, oh my God, that child. Some would look at me with that pity, which was really something that I hated. I really hated to be pitied, and some judged. And I think judging people is just cruel. And having said that, I used to judge too. I remember once seeing a woman with maybe a five-year-old in a pushchair and thinking, oh, she should get that kid to, you know, walk on. And who knows, you know, that's the thing, we judge so easily, and I used to do it myself. And then you'd get the really good, you know, the do-gooders who would say, oh, you're so blessed and you're so lucky and, oh, we've got one of those in the family. And you'd go, oh, really, I don't feel like having this conversation right now. And you'd go into that place where, oh, thank you, yes, I feel very blessed. And deep down inside I'd go, well, you take him then if you feel I'm so blessed.
Did you ever lose your patience, Benny?
Oh, yes, especially when they were rude. You know, one time I got into a lift, and actually it was at North Shore Hospital, and there were three doctors that just looked at Richard in horror. And I was so angry. I said, are you kidding me? I said, please don't stare. That's just so rude.
Three doctors did
that. Doctors. Because it was like he was kind of some sort of, oh, an anomaly that, you know, that shouldn't have happened. And I think this is the worst part about it, is people do think, well, you know, you've made a mistake. That child is a mistake. It shouldn't be here, or it's not going to have much of a life. And the terminology that people use, you know, oh, he's retarded or he's an imbecile. Going out was often a struggle.
Did Richard notice, do you think, when people were staring at him or making comments?
As he got older, he certainly did. Even as a youngster, he had this amazing kind of sixth sense when people weren't comfortable with him. And we did have someone come to the house, a friend, actually, that I used to work with, and she would not make eye contact with him. She would not hold him. And he was a really sweet boy, really sweet. And so he just went and got her handbag and handed it to her and said, you should leave now. And she did, and we never saw her again. And it was so extraordinary. I mean, people are really uncomfortable with disability. And so in the outside world, people would often stare. Not so much now, which I think is really quite interesting, but as a little person, they would stare and stare a lot.
Was there a moment when you had a conversation with Richard about the fact that he had Down syndrome?
Do you know, we never have. It's been really interesting. Once I made a terrible mistake of just going into that disabled car park. And he was so angry with me. He said, Mum, I'm not disabled. And I went, oh, okay, sorry, no, I just made a mistake. And he'll pick me up on those things. And I think he knows he has Down syndrome. He knows, and look, and he, I have to say, clever boy that he is, he'll sometimes say, oh, Mum, you know, I can't do that. I'm disabled.
Like the dog did it.
Yeah, just when he wants to get out of something. But he doesn't want to have that conversation. He doesn't care. He just thinks this is who he is. And that's great. I love that he leads the way with that.
What about for you and the sense of yourself as a mother? Were there times when you felt, oh, I'm supposed to fulfill some saintly expectation of the mother of a child with special needs? How did you manage that expectation on you?
Oh, well, I didn't actually. So I think that's, you know, I ended up going to see a shrink. I took antidepressants because I did not cope with not so much being the mother of Richard, but going into this world that was so alien to me and that expectation. But of course, as time goes on and you find your place in this new life, you do step back and go, okay, how am I going to deal with this? So my initial thing was always, I'm fine. We're fine. He's delightful. He's gorgeous. and the struggle of that, but also that I wanted people to love him as much as I did and see the good things that he brought into the world and life. But for me, it was a real struggle to just not cry. All the, like the emotional side of his life was really weighed very heavily on me.
How different was life for kids with Down syndrome, even a generation before Richard's?
Oh, pretty tough, I think. A lot of babies were taken away and put in institutions. I actually, at one stage, the television blew up, and so the guy came to look, and he was about 60 years old. And Richard, and I had Richard on my hip, and we answered the door, and he literally stepped back and said, "Oh, is that your son?" And I went, "Yes." And he started to cry, and he said, "We had to give ours away." And I actually, not long after Richard was born, a friend's mum rang me to say, "You know, you can put him in an institution." And could you imagine? Like, it's just, I can't even think how anyone would just do that, to just hand over your child.
And what kind of life expectancy was there for kids with Downs in those institutions?
It was not good, because they just weren't cared for. And at that time, we were told that Richard's life expectancy wasn't going to be great. And of course, now we know there's lots of great things that happen where, and care and parents who are much more proactive, that are, you know, really going to fight the fight for their kids, and better exercise regimes. Because, you know, we talked earlier about the low muscle tone. That also affects health. So life expectancy now is much better, but then it was not good. And I don't know statistically what it was.
But so that wasn't an inevitable part of Down syndrome. It was just kids weren't being looked after.
Well, look, if they had a hole in the heart, which sometimes happens, and that wasn't picked up, then of course they'd die from heart complications. Or if they got pneumonia, they weren't looked at. And, you know, so it was, I think, more lack of care rather than lack of the actual syndrome itself.
How accurately can Down syndrome be tested for now, Benny, before birth? I mean, is it something that parents can be very clear about before they give birth?
Yeah, you can, actually. And I think more and more people are pushed into that, you know, have your child, you know, have your pregnancy tested. You might have a child with a something, and of course you can have a termination. Now, I have a real issue with this, because what makes me really cranky, I mean, first of all, it's your choice. You know, every family makes that choice based on their own value system, and I get that, and I don't, you know, that's their view entirely. What I really get cranky about is that the medical profession go, "Oh, you know, you need to terminate if you have a child with Down syndrome." And yet doctors will do anything they can to save a 20-week-old preemie baby.
Do you ever wonder yourself what decision you would have made if you'd known for sure before Richard was born that he had Down syndrome?
What do you know? How do you know? How do any of us know what is around the corner? The decision wasn't there. I didn't know, and I'm really, really glad I didn't.
The rates of testing and the accuracy of testing, I think, means that the general population, or the spread of people with Down syndrome in the population, is shrinking. I think in countries like Iceland, there's almost one person left in that society with Down syndrome. And I think in Australia, the termination rate is something like 90% or so.
I mean, termination rate in Australia is high. And in Iceland, I believe, and I could be wrong here, that you actually have to have the test. You cannot not have the test. That's why their population is so low. What I can gather, although statistically terminations are higher, our population is ever increasing, and we have a lot of migrants here who aren't getting tested. And in, say, like the US, I think because there's such a big Christian community there, they don't have testing either. So it really is, you know, we're not completely making people with Down syndrome extinct, but in some countries they are, which is, you know, really? We move highways to save the yellow snotty-nosed frog, and yet, you know, so that doesn't get extinct, and that's great. But, you know, we want to make these beautiful people extinct. I just don't get it.
What would it mean for a society to have people with Down syndrome not in it? I mean, what does that mean beyond the individual and the individual family?
Wow, that's a really big question. I can only go by my own family. Well, actually, with Richard. Now, I see Richard in his workplace, Sarah, and that kid brings so much laughter and joy to that community. He works in a pub. They love him there. He's one of the boys. He rings up and says, "Mum, can I put $20 on the Super Bowl?" Because he's very male. And they help, you know, I think it just makes people realise that there's so much joy and acceptance to be had. and give everyone a wide berth.
Tell me about Richard now. He's in his late 20s. What kind of a man is he? How do you describe him to people?
He's a bloke. Like, Richard is actually quite masculine and quite male and loves his rugby league. He loves his sport. He loves his family. You know, one of his mottos in life is always, "Mum, family first." You know, if I want to cop out of a family, do it's him that will make me go. He is incredibly kind. He's generous. He's thoughtful. He can also be really grumpy and cranky. He is incredibly loving and loyal. He's a beautiful soul and a really good person. I'm really proud of the fact that he's like that. He is extremely punctual, so don't be late. And he always gets to work on time. He likes his rules. He likes things in a certain place. And he doesn't like to miss out on anything, especially food. He loves eating.
How important are the South Sydney Rabbitohs in Richard's life?
I actually said to Richard one day, I said, "Richard, what's been the happiest day of your life?" And he said, "Mum, when the Bunnies won the grand final." He loves them. And it's been really interesting. He's, God love him, if I gave him $10 and said, you know, "Bring me back the ch-," he has no idea, you know. But if I said to him, "Rich, how much does, you know, the Bunnies need to win the game?" He'll just tell me, just like that. It is his everything. He will watch them. He will watch replays of their games. You know, it's every single player. At the moment, he's jumping for joy because Latrell Mitchell has just joined the team. It's a community. You know, that's what I think he loves about it too. He loves being in something, being part of something. It's like a tribal thing for him.
You described that he works at a pub now. How was it for him to find work? What kind of process was that for him?
Oh, look, that was, for me, that is one of my biggest pride of Richard, is that he did this work experience. So there was, after you leave high school, you've got several options, of which some of them weren't great, but one of them was a thing called transition to work. And we set up a program where young people with intellectual disabilities go straight from high school and they learn life skills and they do work placements and also go to TAFE. So Richard had several work placements which weren't fantastic, but then
what wasn't good about them? What didn't work for
him? Didn't work was, one, they just weren't suitable. So he's a really social person. He loves people. So they put him in a video rental place with this other guy who was a goth who spent his whole life just looking at his phone and make Richard do all the work. So that didn't go down so well. The other was stacking shelves in a supermarket, and Richard's really short, so he found that just a little bit challenging. So it was more about appropriateness. So this job was about talking to people and being, again, in a community and being active all the time because he gets bored. He did this work placement and it worked out really, really well. And he rang me one day and said, "Mum, I've got the best news." And I said, "What's that, honey?" And he went, "They've offered me a full-time, part-time job." And honestly, Sarah, that I think was his defining day. He went from being boy to man because he did that. He was there at work all on his own with these great people that just went, "Right, we're going to take you on. We're going to make this work." And it doesn't take much, Sarah. And for that, Richard's life has completely changed, and consequently so has mine and everybody else, because he is engaged. And they made that happen because people were patient and could see that with a little help. And there's a really great backup for that too. There's a company that not-for-profit that helps people called Job Support, and they will come and help those people on the job and train. And all these things put together, you know, Richard is now part of society. He works. He gets a wage. He gets holidays.
Working in a pub, you know, customers can get a little bit tough, I imagine, sometimes. How does Richard handle people who aren't on their best behaviour or who are giving him a bit of hassle? What's his strategy for dealing with that?
You know what? Not many people do. Although they did get robbed once and he thought that he was standing. I shouldn't laugh about it, but he kind of took it all in his stride. I mean, the poor girl behind the counter, I'm sure it was difficult. But, you know, he kind of went, "Okay, I'm going to get out of the road." And
he was there when there was a robbery.
Yeah. So he, you know, he's aware because people have told him what needs to be looked for. But the patrons at the pub are fantastic. There's a footy tipping competition, of which Richard has won the last 2 years, so they give him heaps in that very male and female way where, you know, he's teased. He stands on his own 2 feet. At first he found that difficult because he took it quite personally. And as he's matured, he's been there now 7 years, he's just one of the gang. you know, we'll be walking down the street and people will go, oh, g'day, Rich. And I'll go, who's that? And he goes, oh, just some guy from the pub. It's interesting that he's got friends that I don't know. And it's funny. I never expected that to happen.
He's also got a girlfriend. How did he meet his partner, Ashley?
Oh, Ashley. Ashley and Richie went to school together and they were really good friends, really great friends. And Richie really liked Ashley and Ashley really liked Richard. And Ashley was going out with somebody else. And when they broke up, Richard was in there like a shot. It was like, he rang me up and he said, I'm going to ask Ashley to be my girlfriend. I went, is that too soon? Like literally it had been like a week.
He saw his opportunity.
He absolutely. And he was in like a shot and they've been together ever since. I think it's 8 years now. They've been living together for 3 years. Ashley doesn't have Down syndrome. She's globally delayed. And we work around both their differences. They really are like an old married couple. They have each other's backs. They argue. They cook dinner together. They go out. They have their own separate friends. And they're very, very happy.
I think about you said when you moved in with your boyfriend, your mum put a sheet on her head and wailed. How did you cope with your son moving in?
I put a sheet over my head and wailed too. But in the privacy of my own home, thinking, oh my God, what have we done? But what was so interesting was they were not fazed at all. They were incredibly, this is our place. We are now living together. And it was something to behold, Sarah, and they've never looked back. They've had their moments and we've had our moments with that. But, you know, Ashley's parents are fantastic. Richard's dad and his stepmom are fantastic. Me and my partner are fantastic and the two of them are fantastic. So we just all lobby to make sure that they're A, safe, B, happy. But even the people that live in their block of apartments are terrific. You know, the community knows them. And so they're very happy.
What was it like the first time you went over to Richard's place for dinner? What do you remember about being hosted as a guest at his house?
Richard does this thing when he's very proud of himself that he almost, you know, he's so excited, like he's just going internally burlesque. He's like, wants everything to be perfect. So he gets a little bit anxious. They had the table beautifully set. They had my favourite wine, water glasses, some flowers on the table. So they had everything beautifully, you know, they observe things. They know what is proper. And I think that's a really important lesson is that, you know, just because someone has an intellectual disability doesn't mean they don't know what is there, what is appropriate and what is a nice thing to do. I can't even remember what the meal was, but I remember sitting down thinking, oh, wow, thank you, God. Thank you, God. This is just beautiful.
What's next for Richard? What's the next big stage that he wants to mark, Benny?
Well, I think he would actually like to play for South Sydney Rabbitohs, but I think that's not going to happen in a quick hurry. So I think, you know, the footy season's just starts. So poor old Ashley now becomes a footy widow because, you know, they go to the games. Looking to her credit, God love her. She loves her man. She's now a member of the Bunnies as well. They've all got, both got the
take
gear.
Take me, take the Bunnies.
Absolutely. And so they go to games all the time. So they live in a funny sort of way week to week, but they plan months and years ahead. So Richard next year turns 30, so we're off to New York. That's his next big adventure.
Well, we've got a little bit of audio of you speaking to Richard about that trip to New York. So let's have a listen to Richard.
Well, so next year I am turning 30, but your mum's taking me to New York and she's put me in business class. And we're going to have lots of fun, like do tours and hang out, go for swims, not eat too much junk food. I've got a Gossip Girl tour and a Sex in the City.
Have fun. And what else are you looking forward to?
Spend time with Mum.
Oh, that's lovely.
Richard speaking there to you, Benny, about the trip to New York. So a Sex in the City tour.
Oh, yeah, because I had to suffer all his terrible, as I said, wrestling things. So he used to make me sit down and watch the most appalling television I did. So I used to make him sit and watch Sex in the City with me. So he knows a lot about women now. So we went to London a couple of years ago and we did the whole Harry Potter thing. And we've been to Greece and did the Mamma Mia. You know, he loves all that stuff. So he's really excited about that. I think he and Ashley, I shouldn't say this too loudly, but hopefully they'll get married one day. That's also on the horizon for them.
Have they spoken to you about wanting to have children? How have you had that conversation with him?
Yeah, it was a big conversation that we had to have because Richard really values family and he really, I think, wanted to have family of his own. But, you know, the way life is for them, that's not a possibility. And they both understand that. So they're both very fortunate that they have two godchildren, one each, that they love. So Ashley has her little godson and Richard has his godson, Charlie. And that's where they put a lot of their joy and love. I think they're quite happy with the fact that, you know, they have chosen not to go down that road. We've had lots of talks about it and the sadness and the loss of not being able to do that. But they're pretty pragmatic people as well, and they know they have a very good life and that they also get joy from their extended family and these beautiful godchildren.
If you could go back in time, Benny, to that cluster of worried nurses and doctors around your bedside when you held baby Richard in your arms, what do you think you'd say to them?
Yeah, I'd say, well, didn't we prove all of you wrong? and look, I think, interestingly enough, that paediatrician, Dr. Grass, from the moment we went into her rooms, she addressed Richard all the time. And that, you know, we were lucky. We had lots of good medical people, really good social people around us that didn't pity us, that, you know, expected good things. And I think, you know, professionals need to lift their game. It's not terrible. It's a blessing. You know, all babies are a blessing. And I think take away the stigma from what is and see what can be. And Richard, my God, what a great life. You know, this the next 3 weekends, I can't see him because he's got social activities on and I'm sitting at home reading a book while he's out having the time of his life. So isn't that great? And I think it's just because people have given him, us, opportunities. You know, primary school that accepted him with open arms and the community that worked around that. It doesn't take much, Sarah. So I think, yeah, that's, you know, I see this boy, this man, and I'm so incredibly proud of what he has achieved because he knows he can have a great life, as most people with a disability can.
Congratulations on your son. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Benny Agius was my guest on Conversations today, and Benny's book is I'm Staying at Richard's. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.